Okay. Does that come through?
Yes.
Yeah?
That's good.
Wow.
If you're happy with this, depends if you actually want to amplify the room or not.
You're asking me, do I need to be amplified?
Depends whether you want to just talk acoustically to the room, in which case the microphone being on is just used for the recording.
You know what? So we're not recording, so maybe I don't bother because. But they're not going to record it. Andy?
Sorry.
Are we recording?
We're probably not because we're not.
Oh, I was going to record the video and the audio.
Oh, I see. All right. So what is it about the resolution?
Normally we capture the slides separately, and
I
can't.
I see. You can't capture the slides, but you can record your picture.
Oh, that would be nice to capture
well
the slides
audio.
Separately.
Yes.
Okay. I'll go with this.
But on the other hand, you could always send us the slides after the event, did you not?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Can I? Okay.
If you want to, I can't do anything with them. We've posted them online, but yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Right.
Good. Thank you. So we usually start at 20 past, which is 5 minutes after when we say we start.
Yes, I yes. This
and if you kind
UK
of
start time
continue till about 15 past or so, then that would be perfect.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Or if I stop earlier, that's okay.
Well, yeah, whatever. Yeah.
I might.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Connecting to projectors. Sometimes, anyway. I mean, I think I know what I'm doing with my laptops, but every so often I get completely caught out by something just won't work. I mean, one time it was that the chip.
Hey, Bernadine.
the chip on the D sub thing had burned out, so it was never going to work.
Maybe we shouldn't think about this, but
you couldn't change the resolution of his slides up from 800.
You know, I've got a lot of extra things to bring up, so this isn't going to mess that up, is it?
You mean extra windows?
Yeah.
I mean, it will change the size of them.
Oh, no, okay, let's not do it. Okay. They asked me, Peter, can you do this? They asked me, Peter, can you do this? And I thought for a second, no, Berdine's not here, I can't do this. You remember, that was always the answer. Josh! Indeed, yeah. Hi.
Lecture theatre, which is everybody come when they're going to come late, which everybody always does, they can only get in there. So the whole thing fills up on this side, and there's always loads of space over there. Mm. So we took out the entire back row of seats to pass through. Yeah. But psychologically,
it's a solution.
That, you see,
yeah.
But they have to know that they can.
Thank you.
Cunningham is visiting at the moment. There he is. Introducing you, but I'll try and keep Mitch.
Thank you, yes, yes. No embarrassment. It's quite a good room, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not bad. Yeah. And it's okay acoustically as well. You don't really need a microphone if you use it.
Yeah.
Winter, it does get a bit chilly. But the audiovisual equipment is a crock of shit, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah?
We got it from a company that went bust while it was putting it in, and it's never been that great. And now, 10 years on, it's in dire need of renewal.
Isn't
we find like the wiring is kind of, you know, fallingly difficult to get at, and it's really irritating.
There are always problems with these things.
Yeah.
I even gave a talk at Microsoft once where they taped it and they were going to send it to Seattle.
Oh, yes.
And they couldn't manage. Then at the end they said, well, we didn't really get that. So. Whenever you think, I'm ready.
You switch on?
I think so.
Okay, hello everybody. Welcome to the Digital Ag seminar. Today, we think the science at Queen Mary. We've done many different things to bring logic together with programming languages, but probably the thing he's most well known for is separation logic, which does bring logic together with programming languages, what it might sound like. And he spent quite a lot of years trying to push that work towards practitioners through the use of tools that he and his collaborators are building. And I guess we'll hear a bit about that this afternoon.
Okay, so the title is From Separation Logic to Systems Code. And logic and systems code, they haven't always had so much to do with one another. So I thought I would give you a little bit of context before we begin. So the separation logic, it's a theory created by John Reynolds and I and others around the turn of the millennium. It didn't have a completely practical motivation. The idea was basically this. So there was this beautiful thing from the 1960s, Floyd Horlogic. And it was absolutely wonderful. But for certain kinds of programs, Floyd Horlogic started to get a little bit messy. One of the principal kinds of programs where it started to get messy, so that the proofs weren't very easy or very nice, was any programs that use pointers. And so basically, I mean, my part in it is just irritation. So I can remember in the late 1990s trying to do proofs in various formalisms about programs with pointers and just getting irritated. So as a theoretician, when you get irritated, that's what you do. You try to clean up and make something a bit simpler. So it was merely a theoretical motivation such as that. Now, coincidentally, around the turn of the millennium, there was a flowering of research in automatic program verification. So there are tools such as SLAM from Microsoft, and there's Astri from Paris, and which do very impressive things. And coincidentally, one of the areas where they have great difficulty is anything to do with pointers and the heap. And so after having created the theory, separation logic, I got involved with very many practical colleagues, more practical than me. They're theoreticians as well. So their Space Invader team are these fellows. And we're going to see the Space Invader tool a bit later. And I also get dragged into this automatic program verification area by our colleagues Josh and Byron, who are here. So it was a big mix-up of ideas and collaboration over a number of years, which ended up taking the theory towards something a bit more practical. So what I'm going to do in this talk is I'm going to presume that it's a general audience and you don't all know about separation logic. And so we'll go through some of the basics, but we won't go too far into it. And when we go through the basics, perhaps I'll point out some of the difficulties in Horlogic that we had to overcome in order to get a decent theory. But we'll go over that to some extent. And then we'll get into what I call how to cook a static analyzer. So once you've got this new theory, there's various things you can do to try to cook a static analyzer. And this actually gives us some new ingredients to get a new recipe for static analysis. And so at the end, I'm going to give you this new recipe, which lets us do some things that we couldn't do before. Okay. So without further ado, part one, the basics. So separation logic is this formalism of heap partitioning. So there's this thing, the separating conjunction, the star. And I read the formula there as x points to y and separately y points to x. And the star formula is true if you can find a partitioning of the heap such that one of the points to facts or one of the assertions is true of one of the partitions and the other of the assertions is true for the other partition. And then when that's the case, then the separating conjunction is true of the entire heap. Now, this can be a little bit confusing. People often say heaps are graphs, but what I've got here is I've got y points to x and yet to nothing. So what does that mean? If I'm forced, I could drop down a level of detail into the RAM model to disambiguate these diagrams. So let me drop down for a second. So if I was forced to go into more detail, I would distinguish between the environment, so x has value 10, y has value 42, and the heap, or the memory. At position 10, I have 42, and at position 42, I have 10 in memory. So you can see how this kind of structure for a RAM model would correspond to this sort of diagram, right? Then when I look for my partitioning, what I do is I take away one part. See, when I take away this part, I take away part of the memory, but not the environment. So you can see that x points to y and yet to nothing means that x, 10, holds 42, and 42 is not allocated. So this diagram where x points to y and not and yet to nothing can be completely disambiguated and made sense of in the low level of the RAM model. Right? So the only reason I'm showing you that is because when people see these diagrams for the first time, these x points to y and yet to nothing, they can become a little bit confused. But there's nothing confusing if we drop down to this lower level. So with that having been said, now for the rest of the talk, I'm going to work completely at the level of the picture semantics. But you should always understand that to disambiguate matters, if forced, I would drop down a level into the RAM model. Okay? So we'll work with the picture semantics. Okay, so there's this pictorial semantics of separation logic. So generally, we'll have a connective star, and separately, And we have two assertions on either side of star, which don't have to be just these points to assertions. They can be any, they can denote any set of heaps. Now, the first thing to recognize about this n separately is I call it a conjunction, but it's not, it doesn't satisfy all of the rules of normal logic. So here's one of the rules, which is called contraction, which is if I have A, then that entails A and A. And so in separation logic, if 10 points to 3, then it's not the case that 10 points to 3 and separately 10 points to 3, for the very simple reason that if I have a heap, there's no way to split it in two ways such that the same cell, 10, goes both ways. So another way to put that is I don't have this principle because you can't be two places at once. There's no way to split the heap such that 10 goes both ways. There's another principle of logic called weakening, which is that A and separately B, or A and B entails A in normal logic. Now, in separation logic, it's not the case that if 10 points to 3 and separately 42 points to 5, then 10 points to 3. I haven't actually told you the reason why. Somebody who hasn't seen the logic before, I haven't given you enough information to figure out whether this is the case or not. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play a little game, and I don't know if you'll be able to succeed in this game, called abduction. So abduction means figuring out what are the reasonable premises behind a statement, say, I have just made. So since I haven't given you enough information, is there anybody in the audience who doesn't already know separation logic who can figure out why that entailment shouldn't hold, given that I haven't given you enough information for it? So I'm asking you to do a strange kind of inference. Tell me the hypothesis. I know, I didn't. Is there anybody who does know separation logic a little bit? Namely, not, say, Josh Burdine or Samin Ishtiak, who might be able to give me the answer to this question. Andy Gordon? Because why wouldn't this hold here? I won't go on in this vein, but I might ask the audience several more questions during the talk. So this confused us. The first version of separation logic did have this principle, but we interpret 10 points to 3 as saying 10 points to 3, and the heap is a singleton. There's nothing else in the heap. And so this means there are exactly two heap cells. This means there's only one heap cell. And so you see, in the first version of separation logic, we were allowing, when I said 10 points to 3, I meant 10 is in the heap and it points to 3, and there might be all kinds of other stuff. But then this is a much more exact version. And we came at this later because I was wedded to garbage collected programming languages, and I was totally afraid of memory deallocation, and I thought it was horrible. And so I set about to prove a theorem to the effect that if you have deallocation, you can't have a nice program logic. And so then I failed in proving that theorem, and the counterexample to that theorem was basically a logic with this kind of property, which makes very exact statements about memory, which is what you want when you've got a non-garbage collected language. So we succeeded in getting a logic for C, whereas our aim was to have a logic for ML or Java. But that's life. That's the way things treat you sometimes. So now, being a bit more mathematical just for a second, we could be more precise about what the logic is. We can say that a formula in the logic denotes a set of heaps. And what we do is we add to classical logic a formula emp, which denotes the empty heap, this formula, which denotes the singleton cell, x holding y, and the separating conjunction, which you read like this. And then we add various other things, inductive definitions. You need inductive definitions always when reasoning about data structures in computer memory. And we add other exotica, which won't come up during the talk. And so now, if I was forced to be completely precise about the model, I would say the RAM model can be described like this. A heap is a finite partial function from natural numbers to integers. So the natural numbers on the left are the addressable locations. And the star combination, what it does is it takes union of finite partial functions as long as the domains are disjoint. Otherwise, if the domains overlap, it's undefined, even if they're consistent. If the domains overlap, it's undefined. And so this just implements the idea of partitioning that I've been expressing so far. Now, going slightly more mathematical too, if we step back from a particular model, there's a nice algebraic structure, which is that the heap partitioning, or heap combination, is a partial function from heaps, cross heaps to heaps. It's basically a commutative monoid, partial commutative monoid structure. This induces the separating conjunction, which takes power set of heaps, cross power set of heaps to power set of heaps. And this is just the mathematization of some of the words I've been using so far. So a heap is in the separating conjunction if there exists two other heaps, and this heap is their combination, and heap A is in the A proposition, and heap B is in the B proposition. So this is just the mathematization of the kind of words I've been talking about, and separately, and so on and so far. There's another interesting thing to note, is that this separation logic can be seen as a kind of modal logic, right? So it can be seen as a substructural logic, but a modal logic as well, where this star connective is like a binary diamond modality. And so the exists here is like you get in the diamond modalities of modal logic. So then what this all adds up to is the algebraic structure of the logic is that you've got a Boolean algebra, the normal Boolean algebra of classical logic from the power set of heaps. Then besides that, this algebra also has what's called a residuated monoid structure, which is just to say that the separating conjunction and amp form a total commutative monoid, and there's this thing corresponding to related to star like usual and implies by the deduction theorem of logic. So in any case, that's the kind of algebraic structure we have. So I just wanted to do those two theoretical slides for the theoretically minded to see the kind of structure we've got. But now, what we've done so far is I've defined a kind of logic with a notion of heap partitioning, and I've given you a few example formulas. But now you might think that there's something quite weird going on here. I mean, it turns out, so I've given a strange logic with this and separately conjunction to talk about heaps. And so there's a weird logic to talk about heaps. You might ask, why would you ever bother to do anything like that? I mean, why not just use normal, good old classical logic to talk about heaps? So it turns out that as far as expressing properties of sets of heaps, power sets of heaps, separation logic doesn't add any expressive power to classical logic. You can define whatever you want in classical logic, and separation logic doesn't add to it. So then you might wonder again, I mean, that's quite an esoteric thing to do then, since I can already define all of these things. So why would I bother? So if it was just about defining sets of heaps or defining assertions, then there would be no interest and there would be no point. The only time the point comes has to do with actually what's the most difficult part of Hoare logic, which is reasoning not about the states themselves, but about the dynamics, the change of the states. And so it's the interaction between memory and operations which change memory, which is where the point of this wacky logic, if you will, comes out. And so this can be explained as follows. So whenever we have, there's an operational idea that every programmer understands of in-place update. So the separating conjunction allows us to lift this operational idea to an idea in logic. So for each of the axioms in a programming language for manipulating heaps, heap mutation statements, we have an axiom, a Hoare logic axiom, which can be described as a logical cousin of in-place update. So let me just explain this. So if this statement, box x gets 7, means go to position x in memory and change it to 7. Now this precondition says, if x points to something and separately p holds, that means p holds for some other memory not containing x. So then if I mutate x so that it holds 7, then, well, p will still hold because that was for some separate area of memory. So you see that, you see how I can update this part of my assertion without changing this other part of the assertion. So this is one of the places where traditional Hoare logic would have gotten complicated. When you deal with this kind of assignment in traditional Hoare logic, you have to run through the assertions and do all kinds of alias checks. So this gives us, at least if our precondition is in the right form, it gives us a way to short-circuit the need for all the alias checks. Here's dispose, or in C you would call it free. So actually, I mean, because I'm a theoretician, I don't actually care about the syntax. So I realized that I'm going to use different notation throughout the talk for the operations in the programming language. Here it will be dispose and cons. In C it would be malloc and free. Okay, and so malloc and free will possibly make an appearance as well. But this is what we were so scared of when we began separation logic, or before it was around, because we thought that any axiomatization of this had to be really bad. But actually, it's quite nice. Suppose X points to something. It's a singleton heap, right? And separately, P holds. Then if I remove that from the heap, then, well, yes, P will be true afterwards, right? So that's not so bad. Now, cons is allocation. I'm writing with a binary points to here instead of a unary one, but that's OK. So suppose P holds before, and I allocate a binary cons cell, and I put it in X, then afterwards, P will hold, oh, yes, and separately, because it wasn't around before, X will point to AB. So that's a nice explanation of allocation. So that's nice. Now, so that's nice, because what you've got is there were, before separation logic, there were complicated axiomatizations of these. And so it's somewhat simple axiomatizations of these three. But actually, if this was all we did, just the axiomatizations of these little operations, it still wouldn't get you very far. Because the real complication in reasoning about programs comes not in reasoning about these individual statements, but comes in reasoning about larger statements, procedures, modules, and whatnot. So the interesting thing is now I'm going to show you how to take this in-place reasoning idea and bump it up a level to higher level, to larger statements. And so this bumping up a level is what's going to give us the opportunity to then have new ways to do program analysis tools.
Question?
Yep.
Can you just say something about the side conditions in the third one and not in the second?
Well, the second one doesn't change the variable x. The variable x holds a value, and that's a pointer, and it's allocated. This doesn't change what that variable holds. It just says that it's no longer allocated. This actually changes what the variable holds. So if x was in the precondition, so this allocates a cell and changes the variable x. If x was free in the precondition, then I would have to do what people who have taken Hoare logic courses, as they've done at Cambridge, you would call it Floyd trickery, right? Because Floyd's assignment axiom going forward introduces an existential quantifier in the postcondition, right? And so that's just trickery to get around the problem I've just mentioned, the fact that x changes. So there is a version of this axiom when x is free in P, and that just employs Floyd existential trickery to deal with that. Okay. Now, so I'm going to illustrate this in-place reasoning on the higher level by starting to go through a little program proof. So my little program proof is I've got an inductive definition for describing trees, first of all. So I say that E is a tree if it's nil and there's no cells, or E points to a binary cons cell. Now I'm saying it's got left and right fields. It points to a binary cons cell, and separately, X denotes a tree, and separately, Y denotes a tree. So the separating conjunction here stops any sharing between the left and right subtrees. The separating conjunction here stops cycles and things like that. So that's what makes this a tree. So in any case, let's start doing a proof. Now, if I've got a tree P and it's not nil, then I know that the second, the else clause holds in this inductive definition, right? So I can unroll the inductive definition. And let me write X primed for the existentially quantified variables there. So I know that P points to X primed and Y primed. And separately, X primed is a tree. And separately, Y primed is a tree, right? Because that's that version of the inductive definition. Then I can read the left subtree out of memory. And I can read the right subtree out of memory. And you can believe me that this would be true at this step, right? So where I had X primed here, now I have I. Where I had Y primed there, now I have J. And so then I'm in position for doing that dispose instruction that I talked about before, which is going to strip this, right? Or I'm going to replace it with AMP. And then I'm going to get left and right subtree. So what I've done here is I've started giving you a program proof. But I haven't told you the specification and I haven't told you the program that I'm proving. But I'm going to tell you that now. So what this is this is part of the proof of a program for disposing a tree, which recursively walks the tree, disposing all the nodes, right? And so first we're disposing the root node, and then we've got the left and right subtrees. Then, well, there's the specification. If we've got a tree P at the beginning, and I call dispose tree, then I get emp at the end. So I have no tree at the end. So the rest of the proof just goes like this. If I've got tree I and tree j, then I do dispose tree. I replace emp, tree I with emp there, and I leave tree j alone. So you see that this is in-place reasoning again. Just like for smaller level statements, we're doing in-place we're updating this assertion in place, but now for the larger statement, disposing a whole tree instead of disposing a single element. Then we replace tree j by emp, and emp star emp, it turns out, is emp. And so that's how we've just done part of the proof of a recursive procedure for disposing a tree. Now, one complicated point is that at here, right, you see tree p, dispose tree p, then I get emp. So I match I with p. So I can replace that with emp, but there's this extra stuff around. You see tree j, this extra stuff. So actually the precondition doesn't match the form of the precondition here. So I would be in trouble normally if I was trying to do program logic at this point. And this is illustrating a really old problem right here. I would be in big trouble because the precondition at the call site and the precondition in the spec don't match. But what we've got in separation logic is we've got this inference rule called the frame rule. And the frame rule is like paying homage to this old problem in artificial intelligence called the frame problem. And the frame problem is that it's extremely irritating to have to always say what an operation that changes things, what it doesn't do. It's extremely irritating. And so this R, what it doesn't do, what it doesn't change, is called a frame axiom. And this is called the frame rule because it lets us for free, in a sense, assume frame axioms. So here, tree J is the frame axiom, which lets us match it up with this call. Here, well, it's an easier case. Emp is the frame axiom, which lets it mesh up with this call. Now, this is so what we've done here is I've just gone through the basics of separation logic. And the basic idea is just that you have got this and separately connective. And furthermore, we can reason about statements. If we write assertions in this sort of way, that at least for some programs, we can reason about them sort of like following your operational intuition for how you update memory in little pieces. Even the larger level operations will update memory in little pieces. So what this sets us up for is actually stage two of the talk. So stage two of the talk now has to do with how to make a program verifier or a program analyzer out of these ideas. Now, the nice thing is program verification can appear sometimes as a very technical and perhaps difficult subject. But actually, to make a program verifier, if you think in the right way, it's conceptually very easy, but there's a lot of hard work. So conceptually, it's easy because you could just pretend that you're writing an interpreter, right? And so most people know how to write an interpreter. And so then if you can write an interpreter, then just do that, except that the things you write your interpreter over aren't the normal states in the programming language. They're assertions in a logic which are like symbolic versions of the states in the programming language. And you can use a lot of intuition from interpreters in order to make program verifiers. But there's a few little key extra points. So this brings us to part two, which is, now I'm going to use this theory, which the idea being, if we can do reasonably simple proofs like this, maybe we can get the machine to guess those kinds of proofs, right? And so now we're going to cook a static analyzer which attempts to guess those proofs. And so there's two parts to it. The first part, which is part two of the talk, cooking a static analyzer, follows some quite standard ideas. Now, instead of trees, to illustrate this part, I'm going to talk about linked lists, and I'm going to use a linked list predicate, which is of this form. So there's an inductive definition, but the important thing is list segment from E to F is a linked list, say, from X here from x to t, which doesn't contain t. It's got something hanging off the end. And so, for instance, I could say, I've got a list segment from x to t, and then I've got a single pointer, t, which points to y, and then I've got a list y all the way up to nil. So again, the pictures in terms of list segments will be good enough for the intuition. But so I'm going to use linked lists to illustrate how to cook a static analyzer. And so cooking a static analyzer, what it is it goes like this. Just write an interpreter. And so it's an abstract interpreter in the sense of CUSO. And all you do is you symbolically execute program statements using in-place reasoning, as I've shown you so far. You interpret while loops, well, a little bit differently than your normal interpreter. It involves finding fixed points. But you interpret while loops by using these, what I'm going to call abstraction rules. If I've got a list segment from x to t primed and a list t all the way up to nil, then I know I've got a list x all the way up to nil. You see, this is abstraction because suppose this means non-empty list segment, then we know that there's at least two elements in this star combination, and we only know that there's at least one there. So we lose information going from one side to the other. And so one of the tricks of static analysis is to figure out when to lose information to make everything converge. So we use this to interpret while loops. And so basically, the trick of static analysis is to arrange things so that you can. The hard parts of Hoare logic are the entailments and the loop invariants. And so the main trick of static analysis is to arrange your P's and Q's to make this easy to figure out and to make these possible to calculate so that the human doesn't have to write the I's and a powerful theorem prover doesn't have to figure out these. Those are the general principles, but it's better to just show what's going on because it's simple enough. So we'll show what's going on to cook a static analyzer with this example program. So we start with an assertion denoting the empty heap. This is a non-deterministic program for generating a linked list of some length. Now, you can imagine that if I get here, if I assign x equals nil, then this assertion will be true, right? X equals nil and emp. You can imagine that will be true at that point. So what I do is I see x equals true as emp. I throw that down into my calculated loop invariant. Now, for even independently of details of the way program logic works, if I go around this loop once, I allocate, I swing a pointer, then I do some other stuff, right? If I go around this loop once, you can believe that, well, now I'll have a linked list of length 1, x points to nil. So I've done some things about forgetting about the variable y here in this assertion. Now, you could either say that y is a local variable there and I don't need to worry about it, or a program analysis very often needs to figure out what are the live variables and what aren't the live variables. And so our program analyses have to figure that out. But just trust me that they do that. But the important thing is you can imagine how, if that's true and I go around one iteration, then that will be true. X is an allocated cell which points to nil. So let me throw that down into my loop invariant. Okay. Now, let me go around the loop again. So now you know that I'll have a linked list of length 2 if I go around the loop again, right? Now, this will be an existentially quantified variable, the x primed. This is where abstraction comes in. What we do is we have a strategy where when we see an assertion at a loop point, and it's got a linked list like this, and it's existentially quantified variables in the middle, we gobble them up and replace them by list segment predicates. So now we have a linked list of length 2. We forget about its length, and we just say, we've got a linked list all the way from x to nil, but it might be of length 5, I don't know. So you see, I replace this assertion by this one. That's the abstraction step, right? Now let me do this again. I'll go around the loop again. I go around the loop again, and you can imagine now, if I've got a linked list from x all the way to nil, and I go around the loop again, then, well, I'll just have an extra cell on the front, right? But now I'll play that same game again, and I'll gobble up that x primed. Oh, he's already down there, right? So now if I go again, I'll get the same thing again. And so basically, I've reached a fixed point. And so I get my fixed point just by symbolic execution together with abstraction at various times. And so this is just how, following that standard strategy, one gets a program analysis which guesses loop invariance. Now, so what this is... Yeah. Yes. There's a set of rewrite rules, and so then the rewrite rules are all true implications. And so what the rewrite rules do is they try to match parts of formulas and simplify them. And so then the rewrite rules need to be true implications, but then there's a bit of an art to the analysis designer deciding which rewrite rules to use. And so I've just illustrated one of the rewrite rules that we use in our tools. Well, I mean, you know, it shows up in a sort of simple-minded explanation of that exact same fact. I'm saying all you do is you just run the interpreter until you can't run it anymore. And that's like saying my lattice is a power set lattice. And I keep, you see these disjunctions down there? I'm keeping adding things to my power set lattice. And so in this very simple thing here, there's a simple finite height power set lattice that we use. And so in the more sophisticated analyses, we use other things, but... Yes, that's all there, and as much as I love abstract interpretation, to understand it to a first approximation, the word lattice is not needed, right? The word interpreter is needed. So, I love abstract interpretation. But so that's all well and good. Now, what I've told you so far, though, is I've told you very standard thing. So we made... Okay, I didn't... So... So we've made a program logic which lets us think about how to update formulas in place. It's like executing a program. Then you can make a static analyzer out of it following this basic idea of interpreters and abstract interpreters. And that gets you some way. So actually, I will compress several years into about 1 minute now. Some number of us then worked really hard. So it's all well and good to know the basic principles of program analysis, but you have to design what's called the abstract domain and try to make it more efficient. And so by following these ideas and working really hard, we were able to prove certain properties of programs, say, up to 1,000 lines of code. Then, after working really hard for another year or two, we were able to prove some properties of programs around 10,000 lines of code. This is quite good compared to the size of code you could prove properties about the heap before, right, which was much smaller than that. But at some point, certain of the colleagues, namely Calcagno and De Stefano, got really irritated by this. So De Stefano hated, well, certain things about how hard it was to set up your analyzer in the first place. Calcagno is a bit of a hacker, and he is embarrassed by numbers such as 10,000 lines. What we did is, so I'd shown you the standard recipe for static analysis. Well, actually, there's a more newfangled recipe coming out of East London, which isn't following completely the standard approach. And I'm going to talk about this in the last part of the talk. It's better to show you rather than to just talk about it. Now, okay. I'm going to put that down there. So here's some C code, right? So there's some struct definitions and things like that in here. And this is delete nested list. So the main thing to notice about this C code is that there aren't any assertions anywhere. There are no preconditions, there are no postconditions, and there are no loop invariants. So now what we do is we run this tool, and that stops. And what this tool does is it reports a precondition and a postcondition. So not only does it find loop invariants, it finds preconditions and it finds postconditions. And so here in pictorial form is the precondition for this code. So just the shape is important enough to you right now. So basically it's saying that there's a nested list. That there's a circular linked list, and off each node of the circular linked list, there's an acyclic nested sublist. So it's sort of a two-dimensional structure. So the code has figured that out. Later, I'll explain to you how it's figured that out. But now just let me go in here. See, here's part of the loop. Now, we're going through a loop, and then if something, then it frees the sublist. It frees the sublist. Now, I'm going to comment this out and hope that this works. Now, this is a call to the nested sublist. And this is, for not the first time in this talk, I'm going to start crossing my fingers and really hoping that something doesn't go very badly wrong in a demo, right? Ah, that picture's changed, yeah? That picture's changed. So it's figured out, whereas it's a circular list, but now there's not an acyclic nested sublist. So I'm starting to illustrate to you what the tool's doing is it's looking at the code, right? And it's trying to prove the code, but it's figuring out what memory you need in the precondition in order to prove the code. So when I first had, this is a procedure that goes around and it traverses a cyclic linked list, and then it traverses the sublist as well. So you need all of that, or the program will core dump. So it figures out that's the precondition. Now, you see, when I commented out the call to the procedure that deletes the nested sublist, it doesn't need that anymore. So now the precondition that the procedure needs is a bit different. It's just that much, right? So I'm starting to get at a word that I haven't used before, which is the word footprint. So this tool is trying to, what it's doing is it's looking at a piece of C code and it's saying, well, I would like a pre and I would like a post for a procedure in the wild. What pre and post might I consider? It's saying, let's try to get the footprint. The pre is the cells that the procedure touches, and then the post is what the procedure does to them, right? So that's a canonical pre-post that you might get from, oh no, there's one more thing I've got to do. That's a canonical pre and post that you might get for any procedure that you encounter anywhere in the wild. So now, this brings us on to, okay, just a second. We've got another bit of a demo to come. This is quite important because when you've got a tool that I give you a procedure or some code and it can figure out the pre and the post, then that opens up several new possibilities. One of the new possibilities it opens up is what I call DiStefano's irritation. DiStefano's irritation was, in order to apply a program verification tool, I've got to read all the code and write some pre's and posts, write some specs, before I ever get started. And so this is quite a problem. Like, for instance, one time some people visited us and they asked us if we could run our tool. They heard that Space Invader was perhaps an interesting tool, and they said, can you write it? Can you run your tool on the code we've got? And by the way, here's the 260,000 lines of code. And they said, we're coming to visit you tomorrow. So then the question is, you can say no, because you need months to change your abstract domain, or you can say, I might be able to tell you something, right? And so this is what I'm leading up to the word compositionality. A compositional analysis lets you analyze at least some pieces of the code in isolation from their context. And so if you can guess pre's and posts, then you can make a compositional analysis. And the most important thing about a compositional analysis is you can get a result out of the compositional analysis of code you don't know without waiting months. And so to illustrate this now, so here's actually that code. And so this is a whole bunch of C code. And so there's some C files, right? And then what this is going to, there's a make file. And this tool is now going to go intercept. When make calls GCC, it's going to intercept the call to GCC and put our program verification tool in the middle. And it's going to try to generate specs for all of the procedures. And it's going to do it for some of them, but not all of them. And I've just said that it's going to do that. And I'm really hoping that that's the case. Please, come on. Oh, I see. OK, so now something's happening. And now, right. So this is that 260,000 lines of C code. And this is saying, what it's done is, oh, so far it's processed 3,000 lines of the C code, oh, 3,600 lines, and it's doing various things. It's found certain number of specs, and it's doing other things. So it's trying to do this compositional analysis now, right? So it's got 260,000 lines to go, though, and I'm hoping, we've got about 15 minutes left, I'm hoping that it's going to finish within the next 15 minutes. So since I'm hoping that it's going to finish in the next 15 minutes, we might as well do something with the remaining time. So my strategy is I would show you a bit of the tool, and so then you can understand the principles. It's easier to understand the principles behind it after having seen it run. So now I'm going to tell you some of the principles behind it. And hopefully while I do that, it will finish. So what the big problem you've got in trying to make a compositional analysis is, if I've got a procedure, normally there's pre's and post's that you might consider. There's an enormous variety of pre's and post's to consider, right? And so which ones am I going to pick from, the pre's and post's? So our heuristic is this footprint idea that I described. So I've got some math here to describe it, but let me say that the input footprint of a procedure is the cells that it touches. Let me just say it like that. And then if I know the cells that a procedure touches, then I can calculate, if I have a perfect program analysis, I could calculate the post condition of that. And so this is the canonical specification for procedure that our analysis is going to shoot for. Now, because analysis is trying to solve an undecidable problem, we can't get the perfect spec, right? So we're arranging our analysis to aim for this, and we're going to fail because of undecidability sometimes. We're going to approximate it, but this is the ideal that we're shooting for. And it's very important to have an ideal to shoot for, because as I said, otherwise there's an enormity of potential specs to try to choose from. So the first step is, let's get rid of that enormity and shoot for one ideal one, even if we won't always get it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that in math, I can define this triple, but in terms of a particular logic, I might not be able to. Oh, well, in the logic, you just can't express it. Yeah, I mean, in the fragments of the logic that we use, which are oriented to program analysis, you absolutely can't express it. So in math, though, but by when me and Josh talk, and I say in math, I mean you can use any infinitary construction you want, right? And so then I can express it. Now, So you're aiming for the small specs that describe the footprints. Now, we've had an example small spec before. Okay, so let me skip past that. So there was part of the proof that I gave you before by hand, right? Now this is quite interesting. This is the first part of our new recipe for program analysis. If I'm to automate the use of this rule, then well, where do these things come from? I have to infer. Usually you infer the loop invariants in program analysis. I have to infer these things, the frame axioms, so in order to automate this part of the reasoning. So what's interesting is automating this turns into a new entailment question. And so normally entailment is like this. So the entailment question that we consider, so this was Josh and Cristiano Calcagno started this entailment question around 2002 in their tool called Smallfoot. And so what you do is instead of asking A entails B, you say A entails B and some leftover stuff. So you might have to find or guess the leftover stuff. So in this case, it's going to be very easy. We'll figure out that the leftover stuff is tree J, right? In this case, we might have to do a bit more work. In some cases, we have to do a bit more work with instantiations of parameters and things like that. But the main thing is, in order to figure out the frame axioms, you need to solve this extension to the entailment question. And the tool that's now running in the background, every single statement that it hits, it calls a theorem prover that answers this kind of question. And the theorem prover is incomplete and extremely fast, which is why it's hopefully going to give some answers before at the end. But you have to answer this question in order to automate that reasoning that I've just shown you. OK, so that's all well and good. Now, So it's automating that kind of reasoning. But now you might say, well, wait a minute. Wait a minute. I mean, I told you that to do a compositional analysis, what you have to do is look at the bare code, figure out the pre, and then figure out the post. But what I've just shown you is, if you give me the pre, I'm going to a way to figure out the post. Where am I going to get the precondition? How am I going to get started? So, just slightly jokingly, I mean, the frame problem, which is the previous entailment question, was from artificial intelligence, right? So now we have to do something entirely more difficult than like that AI problem. We have to figure out our preconditions. And so Space Invader is going to do a very powerful kind of reasoning. And the powerful kind of reasoning is depicted there. And if you haven't guessed what that means, is he's going to do a slightly different kind of question. And a slightly different kind of question is called abduction. And abduction means guessing hypotheses, right? And so you remember I gave you an abduction test early in the lecture, right? And it actually wasn't such an easy test. But in any case, so now we're going to answer questions like this. Now, this abduction question, well, sometimes it's easy. What's the missing bit I need in order to get this? So it's a nice, normally in logic, you solve abduction with AND. With the star connective, it's quite interesting. It's like missing bit of space that you need in order to satisfy this. So sometimes it's very easy. So I would guess list Y there. Sometimes you have to do some other things. So one of the characteristics of abduction is that you don't tend to have unique answers to your questions. So consider this. If Y points to 3, and here I know X points to 3, and there's a whole bunch of other stuff, well, one of my answers is this, right? If Y points to 3 and separately X points to 3, then, well, yeah, that'll be true. Another answer is this. If Y and X happen to be aliases, then I would also get it too, right? So in general abduction, you can get a whole bunch of answers to your abduction questions. And so one of the things is, in order to, you know, as the assertions grow big, the number of possibilities is big, and you could collect them into a disjunction. So there's an abductive theorem prover also calling, that's called at every single step of the program analysis for every statement that answers questions like this. And so so there's lots of heuristics in that theorem prover. And an interesting heuristic is that of these two choices, it only considers this one and not this one. It never considers that one, even though we know that we could consider it. It's quite interesting because you can never completely justify a heuristic in any way that I know, but every program proof, the people of us who've worked with separation logic, no program proof we know of for a correct program has ever used this case. Because this case is when X and Y are some weirdly, sort of weirdly aliased. And what you tend to have is you tend to have that they're aliased for better reasons, like if you go around a loop, then there's a condition, a loop in a cyclic linked list, there's a condition at the end which tests for the aliases, and so then our tool is really good at those. But weird aliasing when there's no conditions, our tool's no good at those, but it turns out that for the most part, those are incorrect programs anyhow. But I mean, I'm trying to tell you that there has to be heuristics to approach things like these, and I recognize that I can never completely justify my heuristics, but nonetheless, we can partially justify them. So there's an art. Whenever you get into the game of abduction, there is always going to be an art and some trade-offs involved. So that's the trade-off we've chosen, and there's some intuition behind it anyhow. So now, there's an abductive theorem prover working, but the more important part that I want to show is, now, presuming I have an abductive theorem prover, how I can guess preconditions and postconditions. Now I want to show you that part. And so the strategy is like this. I've got this procedure, okay? Now I've got another procedure, foo, in the middle. And foo has this specification. So maybe this specification was guessed by the program analysis beforehand, or maybe a human gave it. It doesn't matter. But given this information now, we're going to try to guess a pre and a post for this procedure. So we start with emp. What we do is we allocate something, and then we get x points to nil, right, at this point. Then we have foo. Well, what we do is we take the assertion at this call site, and we try to match it here, right? So what we do is we say, well, I actually haven't got enough. I've got x points to nil, and I don't have anything to do with y. So I haven't got enough information to call this procedure. I can't match the precondition. So one thing I could do is I could just give up. But another thing I can do is I can ask the abductive question. If only I had question mark, then I could proceed, right? So then I call the abductive theorem prover. It fills in the if only I had, well, list y would entail this, right? It's an easy answer for the prover in this case. When I fill, my abductive theorem prover fills this in, and I say, ah, I should have had that to begin. And I throw that back to the precondition, right? I should have had that. Then I would have been able to take all these steps. Yes, it is. Yes. So then I should have had list y in my precondition. So then, if I had list y in my precondition, then I would have been able to satisfy the given pre of the procedure, list y star list x. So therefore, I can continue as if everything was okay, and I'll get list x as the post here, right, from this spec, and then I'll get list return value is the overall post. And so what I've done is, by calling the abductive theorem prover here, I've generated a precondition and generated a postcondition, and I think you'll see that if this is the footprint of foo, then this is actually the footprint of the procedure, right? This is the information you need before running in order to at least get to here in the procedure, in order not to quote dump. Yes? Of the procedure, so a procedure pre-post.
So what did it mean? So why did it make sense to say that list y is a precondition of the whole thing and not just the previous?
Because if you give me a list y here, I guarantee that I can run this procedure without, say, core dumping.
But would it be more precise if you just said that it's just what I get from the previous?
No. The game is to say, I've got a procedure. I want to generate a pre and a post for the whole procedure and then forget about the innards. So I want to generate an abstraction of the procedure because then...
So you spit out all the abduction solutions in as preconditions of the whole thing.
That's part of what I do. That's part... Yeah. There's more... I use abduction in order to generate preconditions. Yes. And so what you want, what you're trying to do is... Okay. So then the context of it is this. So suppose now I've got a big piece of software, right? And so let's forget about recursion and just say, there's a call tree. So now what I do to analyze the software is I do this. I go to the leaves in the tree, and then for each procedure in the leaves, I generate pre-post pairs for that. Then I go up one level, and then I don't reanalyze the bit down there, and I generate pre-post pairs for that, and then boom, I generate pre-post pairs all the way up. You see? So the reason I don't continue report, I forget about that material in the middle, is so... As I go up in the tree, I just use those pre-post pairs to make my analysis go up. So this is a standard idea called bottom-up or compositional analysis. So I've shown you one example how what I did is I called the abductive theorem prover here in order to generate the pre and the post. And I showed you that I had to solve this frame inference problem before. So generally speaking, At every call site, and at every primitive statement as well, we have to call a theorem prover which answers a question of this form. So you have to guess these things, the antiframes, the missing bit of storage, and the frames, the extra bit of storage. And so there's just some fast and very incomplete theorem prover for answering these questions. It's called at every step. Now, let's hope. Yes, it's finished. Now, leaks, oh no. There's some number of leaks here, right? So now I know about this. I know where that isn't really finished. Yes. Now, one of those leaks is at this position in the code, 709. And so I can now figure out, well, what's going on with this leak, right? So now if I look down here, I see. Well, actually, the guy forgot to free something when he returned. So I can just guess, maybe if I just copy that bit of code and put it up there, then maybe that will work. Now, this, I'm a bit worried about this, but now, that was 260,000 lines of code, but this isn't going to take 260, this isn't going to take the same amount of time. Now I'm running. I'm extremely worried about this for, please. Oops. You know what? This is something has gone wrong. But you know what? I mean, this is slightly embarrassing because I've given this demo. I always go like this when I give a demo, right? And I've given this demo now about 10 times, and it's worked every time. And there's something wrong in the demo, and what's wrong is not in the tool. What's wrong is, as I set this thing up beforehand, I've mixed up something to do with the files, right? So actually, normally when I run this demo, there's 70-something leaks, and then I can fix it, and then it proves that one of the leaks isn't there, and it does it quickly because of compositionality. It only does the reanalysis on one little bit of the code instead of all of the code, just because of compositionality, right? Now, probably like within 5 minutes of the end of this lecture, I'll be able to figure out what I did wrong with VI. You see what I mean? This is a VI error. This isn't an error in the, you understand what I'm saying, right? And you understand why the fingers are crossed in the demo. I can figure out my VI error in about 5 minutes at the end, but maybe I won't do that now. But anyhow, so you see that the tool completed. You didn't see that I fixed the error, but you'll have to believe me that the other times that I ran the demo, that worked. And you can also believe that the error is with me and not with the tool. But in any case, so the interesting thing about this is I talked about DiStefano's and Calcagno's irritation. So we used to spend like a lot of time prepping the analysis to run on a piece of code, namely months of time. And so the downside of the analysis that I've just shown you now is that it doesn't prove all of the procedures in a program, right? So it proves some percentages of these procedures, of these bits of code, right? Like of this version of Linux, it proves, finds some spec for 58.4% of the procedures. For OpenSSL, it finds some spec for 61-point-something%. And so there's various criticisms to make. Like you might think a lot of the hard stuff to analyze is hiding in that code that we didn't analyze, right? That's possibly true, although it's not completely true. But the other thing to say is that, say, 61.46% of OpenSSL is like a lot more than 0%, which is where we were a few years ago, right? So the main thing I want to say is that we started off with separation logic, which was intended to. There's lots of confessions about heuristics and things like that. But we started off with separation logic some number of years ago, which was an attempt to deal with some limitations in the originally lovely, but I mean it had some limitations. Hoare logic, and then we got the theory separation logic, and then my colleagues mainly, and I joined along, figured out how can we try to apply the theory. And we were able to apply the theory to these problems in heap analysis and verification to some extent. And then it wasn't merely hard work. Actually, the theory gives us some quite interesting techniques that we might consider using in program analysis. And the chief one that I've talked about at the end, the new fashioned recipe from East London is this question, which I think is, instead of entailment, it's quite an interesting question. It jointly figures out what do I need and what's the extra stuff at the same time. Okay, I'll stop there.
So the programming process that you had before you did this composition business with the bioabduction, can programs verify that analysis can be verified 100% with your bioabduction?
No. This is the general thing about compositional analysis, is that it's going to be compositional analysis good for program. Global program analysis, consider one program, it might know that there are only 10 procedure calls, and it gets more accurate results for that, for those 10 procedure calls. So compositional analysis is, let me just say, it's always going to be less precise. And so, in fact, there is, you were part of some of the previous work, but for instance, there's this FireWire device driver, right? But the top-down analysis verified a property of the FireWire device driver. So first you might go bottom-up analysis, generate like lots of specs. Then, in order to get more precision, you might then go top-down, right? And so you might even call this, in the Kuso sense, it's called narrowing. You might go through a narrowing phase. So in general, the compositional analysis is going to be less precise than the whole program analysis. But the benefit of the compositional analysis is you can run it on code that you could never run the whole program analysis on. But for the code that you can run both on, I think you want to mix.
Hi. So can you give us a few intuitions? For the 40% of SSH procedure, it wasn't possible to get some specs for it. Can you give some intuitions about when does this?
The thing is, I'll give some examples. To get 100%, there's a phrase, we want the magic, I'll call it the magical abstract domain, which nobody's going to find soon, right? Is what's going to get us 100% of any big piece of code. So but any automatic verification technique is going to miss out on certain things. So here's an example of what this particular tool, not the abduction idea, but the particular tool, misses out on. In systems programs, sometimes you have not just linked lists, but sometimes you have one node participating in two linked lists or three linked lists. This is called a multi-linked list. So this exhibits some sharing. And so graphs also exhibit some sharing. So these multi-linked lists, nobody has made an abstract domain that can tractably prove non-trivial properties of multi-linked lists. And yet these exist, these are found in lots of places in Linux. So wherever you find them in Linux, so wherever you find a multi-linked list and you find a loop which iterates through them, our tool is going to give you bad results, namely it's not going to find a spec. Similarly, if Linux does lots of very crazy address arithmetic, and even not so crazy as it might in the kernel memory manager, our tool will fail to find a spec for the kernel memory manager, or it will find a spec that only accounts for several, very few number of calls. So it's like the limit domain. The word abstract domain means the logical formalism that you can do automatic proofs about. That's always going to be limited for fundamental reasons, but even for practical reasons, all known abstract domains are very limited, in that it's really easy to trick them all. And so this tool, you might say, is it's good at finding where it can be tricked.
There's no restriction on what can you get.
Sir. I mean, it's hard to find good parsers, actually. And so if you can parse it, and we can put it into our intermediate form, then we can try to do something with it.
Hi, Peter. You said that you have an idealized semantic model like no concurrency and things like that. Is it content you respect? Do you think it works? So concurrency like sort of corrupt the results that I'm finding?
There's a lot of little precisions. I think they're pretty good in the sense that all they're trying to do is to show you the footprint, right? And you stare at most of these specs, this footprint. Now, but there must be cases, and I mean, I can write the programs to trick the analysis in that way. But I mean, you ask me, and I've given you a great answer, but I don't make any strong claims on behalf of that, because it is an idealized for everybody analysis. It's only found with respect to, and so this analysis is found with respect to a certain model, which, I mean, the model has some limitations, like it ignores concurrency, like so many models in the world. I mean, I'm the practical model in the world. So my answer to Neil was that actually it gives us pretty good specs when it finds me. But it's very idealized, yeah, the model. So.
But despite the optimism of the model, I mean, if hypothesis and say a concurrent separation logic proof. I mean, it doesn't give you a proof, but it's a valid trip.
But triple with respect to that code. What if that code had?
Okay, if it has spawned, then no.
Right.
If it had.
Bit worried about. It's still conservative because it's some non-deterministic choice, but it still might be a valid triple. So Josh is asking, you know, you're treating many program statements non-deterministic and deal with the math. Because it's like more sound than I'm letting on.
But I can.
Okay, I think we should get up to this point. So let's thank Peter again for a very stimulating talk.
Yeah, of course.